This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Great to have you listening in today. Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. I was visiting Kansas City with my family, and we visited an exhibit about Auschwitz, the deadliest German concentration camp in World War II. And this exhibit told the story about how Jews and other special groups in Germany were denied freedoms bit by bit. First, people started to blame them for problems in society. Jewish businesses had to be labeled. Jews were denied access to certain facilities. Then they had to have special identification. Then they were sequestered in certain areas. They were denied property rights. Then they were forcibly moved into ghettos. And finally, they were carted off to camps. And even what was happening in those camps got worse and worse. If you look at any single step in that process, it didn't seem like that big of a deal. But if you step back and you look at the overview, you can see all along where that process was leading. Just looking at that exhibit, you couldn't help but see parallels with the way that freedoms are being limited more and more in our society today. You see people who are treating whole groups of their fellow citizens as second class, and they're becoming more and more hateful. I read a memoir from a survivor of the Holocaust, Viktor Frankl. He was a psychologist. He wrote a book, Man's Search for Meaning, and he was taken to four different camps, including Auschwitz. And in his book, he described one experience that he had. He was in terrible pain in the middle of this camp. He had sores on his feet. They were marching incessantly. The winds were very cold. He was very miserable, and he found his mind consumed with petty thoughts. How to get an extra piece of bread, how to avoid a beating from that one security guard, what to use for a shoelace on his broken shoe. And he wrote this: I became disgusted with the state of affairs, which compelled me daily and hourly to think of only such trivial things. I forced my thoughts to turn to another subject. Suddenly, I saw myself standing on the platform of a well-lit, warm, and pleasant lecture room. In front of me sat an attentive audience on comfortable upholstered seats. I was giving a lecture on the psychology of the concentration camp. So suddenly, Mr. Frankl's perspective on all of his suffering shifted dramatically. He said, by this method, I succeeded somehow in rising above the situation, above the sufferings of the moment, and I observed them as if they were already of the past. How valuable to have that kind of perspective in the middle of such a horrific trial, to be able to rise above that situation, to see things from higher up, to get an overview. How skilled are you at being able to do that? You know that if you're standing on level ground, your eyes are about 5 or 6 feet up above the surface of the earth, and the curvature of the earth prevents you from seeing farther than the horizon, which is about 3 miles away. But if you climb a hill just 1,000 feet high, you can see for over 38 miles. Just a little bit of elevation, and you can see a whole lot farther. And that's true of our spiritual perspective as well. God's thinking is so much higher than ours, and He wants to give us that higher viewpoint. If you climb a mountain, say 10,000 feet, from that elevation, you can see over 120 miles. If you're flying in an airplane at 30,000 feet, like many of us do, you look out the window outside that plane, you can see for over 200 miles at that elevation. God has tremendous perspective. He sees so much more than any of us do. And he says this in the book of Isaiah, chapter 55, verses 8 and 9, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." That's really worth thinking about. If you think about it, you realize what an understatement that is. God inhabits eternity. He created all things. He has perfect character. We come from dust. We live short lives. We're distractible and self-absorbed. Truly, his thoughts are higher than ours. Carl Sagan once said, "If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe." That's a great point. You think about everything that we make, we're just using pieces and parts of things that God already made. But God truly started from scratch. He came up with everything. Think of everything that God created: light, energy, atoms, mass, temperature. He devised intricate physical laws to govern the material elements, the laws of conservation and mechanics, gravitation, relativity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, photonics, quantum mechanics, radiation. God created galaxies. He created stars and planets and moons. He created bacteria and tarantulas, and tuna, and octopi, crocodiles, gophers, peacocks, orangutans. He made you and me, human beings. He made us in his own image. What perspective God has, how vast is his understanding, and how limited is ours? Isaac Newton is widely regarded as one of the greatest mathematicians, physicists, one of the most influential scientists of all time. And he said, "I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me." He had a real humility that most scientists today lack. It's so easy to overestimate our own understanding. We're all limited in our perspective, and God wants to break us out of that. He wants to expand our thinking and stretch our perspective and to give us the big overview. Just imagine sitting down and having the man who invented your laptop to open your computer and explain everything to you. He knows all of its systems intricately. He knows exactly what's going on. Maybe if there's something wrong with your computer, he would know exactly what it was, exactly how to fix it. So say you have a health problem. You're having pain, or your energy is low, your heart is bothering you. You might not know exactly what's going on, but God does. He knows. He knows that marvelous mechanism of your body far more intricately than any mechanical engineer would. Don't just look at that health trial from the ground level. Get some elevation so you can see the wider view, more like God does. Recently, there's been something of a renaissance in the realm of civilian space travel. Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos have created rockets that have launched civilians into space. In July 2021, Branson flew his rocket up about 50 miles. Shortly after that, Bezos flew up to about 66 miles. And you can see a lot from that high up, about 500 miles in a single view. And then shortly after that, in September, Elon Musk's company SpaceX sent an all-civilian crew aboard Inspiration 4. This was the first all-civilian mission to orbit the Earth. They didn't just poke at the edge of space and then come back within an hour. They soared to 364 miles above Earth. This is a higher orbit than the International Space Station. And then they circled the Earth over and over again every 96 minutes for 3 days. And they had stunning views of Earth. the top of the capsule was one massive window, and they were able to see about 1,700 miles in a single view. Now, even from here on Earth, we can see things a lot further distant by looking up at the sky. The moon is an average of 238,855 miles away from us. The sun is 93 million miles away. And we see stars that are much further distant than that. The nearest stars apart from the sun are the triple star system of Alpha Centauri. Those are 25 trillion miles away, 4.3 light years. The distance that light travels in a year, moving at the blistering speed of over 670 million miles per hour. It takes the light 4.3 years to reach us. And those are the nearest stars. And God created all of that. He has stunning perspective on distance because he operates in infinity. He also has stunning perspective on time because he inhabits eternity. And he also wants to help us to grow in our perspective on time. When you're young, your perspective is very limited. Time moves slowly. And the time between lunch and dinner can feel like an eternity. But the older you get, the faster time moves. A day is progressively less of your life, so you've gained some perspective. Well, God is the Ancient of Days. He's been around for eternity. So he sees time very differently than we do, and he has a perspective that can really help us. Psalm 90 is called A Prayer of Moses, the Man of God. And this was a man with some impressive perspective himself. And he writes, "Eternal, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." So he's describing God, and you can tell he's straining at the limits of his imagination. From generation to generation, in 6,000 years of human history, there's been about 150 generations of men who have lived and died, and God has been there through all of them, looking after man in ways we don't even realize. And God is everlasting to everlasting. If you read those words in the Hebrew, it's talking about time disappearing over the horizon. God was God as far back as you can see and as far into the future. And Moses is saying our human minds can't even grasp it. We can't perceive his past or his future. And verse 4 in this psalm says, "For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night." This is one of these remarkable statements in the Bible about what time means to God. 1,000 years is an unbridgeable distance for us in the flesh. Not even Methuselah lived 1,000 years. But God isn't limited by that at all. 1,000 years is like a moment, a flash. Just think about yesterday. You have a hazy memory of it, but it's just gone. 6,000 years of human history are almost over. And to God, it's like 6 days, and it's almost over. Now, Moses, in this psalm, he then contrasts that vastness, that tremendous perspective that the eternal God has with human beings. He says, we are like grass. We grow quickly, we wither and die. We sustain our bodies for a few decades, maybe, and then it's like we had never been. I had the opportunity to visit Manila in the Philippines some years ago, and just seeing the mass of humanity that filled the streets of a very crowded, dirty city with stifling poverty was quite eye-opening. There were mostly naked children who were sitting there in the streets, and really with no prospect for an education, no means of improving their lives. They didn't know anything really beyond a few blocks of this squalid city, and they may never have the opportunity. And they're trapped by their ignorance. They don't know what they don't know. They don't know what lies beyond that experience immediately around them. And in a way, that's true of all of us. You have to travel to even begin to get a sense of how big the world is. You know, it's when you're standing on a mountain that you can begin to grasp the scale. And it's the same as we age, then like Moses, we begin to grasp just how ephemeral life is. Now, these experiences that help to expand our perspective, these begin to take us more into the realm of God's thinking. Moses wrote here, "The days of our years are 70 years and 10, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away." And this is critical perspective on time and on life. If you have that perspective, you live very differently. You use your time differently. You have different priorities. If you really understand just how brief of an opportunity we have in the flesh. And this is the conclusion that Moses drew from realizing this. This is really crucial. Verse 12 in Psalm 90 says, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." Help us to understand how short life really is, how susceptible it is to being cut off, and really how certain it is that it will come to an end. Help us to see that, to motivate us to use our time wisely. The better perspective we have on time, the more we're going to put it to use. "Teach us to number our days," Moses said. Help us to make good use of every one of these precious days. One lesson that Viktor Frankl learned: to survive in a concentration camp, you had to be future-oriented. He said that when a man started to succumb to despair, the way to help, he wrote, had to aim at giving him inner strength by pointing out to him a future goal to which he could look forward. It is a peculiarity of man that he can only live by looking to the future, Frankl wrote. And this is his salvation in the most difficult moments of his existence, although he sometimes has to force his mind to the task. Can you identify with that? It's really when life gets most difficult and the trials are the greatest that we most have to look to the future. We have to be goal-oriented. And it's also in those times when you really tend to have to force your mind to the task, because it's easy for whatever that problem is to completely fill your frame of reference. Frankl wrote, "The prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future was doomed. He simply gave up." And he wrote that prisoners who gave up on life, they were inevitably the first to die. And he said they died less from lack of food or medicine than from lack of hope, lack of something to live for. He told the story of one man who had a vivid dream that he would be liberated on March 30th, 1945. Frankl wrote, "When he told me about his dream, he was still full of hope and convinced that the voice of his dream would be right. But as the promised day drew nearer, the war news which reached our camp made it appear very unlikely that we would be free on the promised date. On March 29th, he suddenly became ill and ran a high temperature. On March 30th, the day his prophecy had told him that the war and suffering would be over for him, he became delirious and lost consciousness. On March 31st, he was dead. To all outward appearances, he had died of typhus." And Frankl talked about just how close a connection there is between our state of mind and, you know, the courage, the hope, or the lack of those things that we have, and our health. And that is certainly true of our physical health, but it's also very true of our spiritual health. Our state of mind and our health are very closely connected. And Frankl wrote, "The sudden loss of hope and courage can have a deadly effect. The ultimate cause of my friend's death was that the expected liberation did not come, and he was severely disappointed." It reminds me of Proverbs 29 and verse 18, where it says, "There where there is no vision, the people perish. We must have vision. We must have perspective on where our life is going and have that future orientation if we are to be able to withstand whatever shocks, whatever trials we might experience in the short term. This is very consistent with what Moses wrote in this psalm about just how important it is that we see the overview of our life and recognize how short it is, and that we use that as motivation to propel ourselves forward. And he says in verse 15, "Make us glad according to the days wherein you have afflicted us and the years wherein we have seen evil. Let your work appear unto your servants and your glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Eternal our God be upon us, and establish you the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish you it." He's talking about what a difference it makes in our lives when we're living the way God wants. And we can rejoice. We can be glad in our days. We can actually see God's glory and understand the great God. And we can allow Him to really establish our work. If anything that we do is to have any real value, then God has to establish it. Otherwise, we get into all kinds of worthless pursuits. But these are marvelous contemplations that Moses had. I think about the young David in Psalm 8, just out there with the sheep, contemplating the heavens' vastness. And that made him consider God and God's relationship to man and man's place in the universe. Being out there in the sheep pasture gave him time and opportunity to think about these things. Too often we're inside, we're looking at screens rather than being outside and considering the heavens. You can also think about Abraham, who it says in Hebrews 11, he dwelled in tabernacles, but he had his heart set on New Jerusalem. He was really contemplating some of the most inspiring truths that there are. Those are the types of contemplations that we really need to have the right perspective on our lives. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about perspective and the benefit of coming to see the big picture. If you're interested in more about those civilian space programs, we published an article in our November-December 2021 Trumpet Edition, Want to Go to Space? You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We'll link to that in the show notes for this program. But really, we're just getting started on the program today. The title of today's program is The Overview Effect, and I'll explain why when we come back. Stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We are living in the last days, the final days of man's rule on earth. And I find it fascinating that we're experiencing such a renaissance in space travel right at this time. Personally, I'm pretty impressed by these space projects that are taking off right now, these people who are actually turning dreams into reality. And they're realizing their desire to explore new frontiers and push the bounds of exploration and so on. I find it quite remarkable. Why is it that people are so fascinated with space? It's an interesting question. When the crew of Inspiration 4 went up, they had stunning views of the Earth. One of the astronauts said it was indescribable. Another one said it was the most beautiful thing I have ever seen in my life. To see the entire sphere of the Earth and then just the blackness of space around you, it's just mesmerizing. There's something very special about getting that big of an overview. Another astronaut aboard said it was so impactful, I couldn't believe it. It was overwhelming. It made me realize that there is so much to see here on the earth that I really want to go out and explore it. Seeing it from above just gives you that introduction to the beginning of probably what life should be. This man got some perspective that actually moved him to want to change his life. Now, it's just on a physical level, but it is moving in the right direction. In Colossians 3, the Apostle Paul wrote, "If you then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things on the earth." That's quite a remarkable injunction. Seek things, set your affection on things that are higher than the things that you have just immediately around you. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, actually wrote about this in the cover story of our sister magazine, Royal Vision, the July-August 2021 issue. And he said, "We need to keep our minds on the Father and Jesus Christ. Set your affection where the Father and Son are set. Christ is risen and seated at the Father's right hand, and they both tell us this is where we want you to set your affection. This is where your real passion needs to be." That phrase, "set your affection," can be translated, "be of the same mind, be like-minded." So Mr. Fleury says, Paul is talking about thinking like God. This is not easy. How can you set your affection so ardently on something that is above, something you cannot physically see? It isn't something we naturally do. We must work very hard at this. Paul also wrote in 1 Corinthians 2, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them that love him. But God has revealed them unto us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yea, the deep things of God." God does reveal those things to us, even deep things, if we work to use the Spirit of God. But God is infinitely deep. Even when we begin to understand the deep things, there's always more depth. We could dive deeper and deeper with all our might, all our energy, and never hit bottom. Now, in this world, there are so many things that draw our attention in the opposite direction, that distract us away from God, that draw us to the pulls of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the allure of this world, that destroy our attention span, that destroy our focus and our depth of thought. We need to fight those things. And we need humility and more of the fear of God and the awe of God so we can more clearly see the majesty of God. I think about Job, who got a vision of God that filled him with terror and awe, and it brought him to dust and ashes repentance. But then he was finally able to see God. You can read about that in the 42nd chapter of the book of Job. "You know, I had heard about you with the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." He got the perspective that he needed. The Apostle Paul's letter of 2 Corinthians shows what a tremendous spiritual perspective that man had. He had so many trials in his life. He suffered horribly, mostly in service to God. But he did an extraordinary job of maintaining the big picture. And he talks in the fourth chapter of that letter about how God's truth is like this glorious light. And we have this, these are contained in these little physical bodies, which are just earthen vessels, just clay pots. It's a marvelous perspective to just remember who you are compared to who God is. And his ways are higher than ours. His thoughts are higher than ours. We're made of clay. He's the almighty eternal creator. And the excellency of the power is all God. But Paul, he talks about all of the trials that we may endure. And he says, none of that can stop what God is accomplishing in us. He says there, we are troubled on every side, yet we're not distressed. We're perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, cast down, but not destroyed. And then he says, knowing that He which raised up the Lord Jesus will raise up us also by Jesus and shall present us with you. You know what this is all leading to, and you can conquer any trial. For which cause, he writes, we faint not. But though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. He's talking about setting your affections on things above. He's talking about maintaining the right perspective, even in the middle of whatever trials you may be going through. And verse 17 says, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. The Revised Standard says, this affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Paul himself experienced imprisonment, hunger, thirst, beatings, stonings, shipwreck. And he turned his thoughts to higher things. He rose above those situations and the suffering of the moment, and he observed them from higher up. He had the big overview. This light affliction, which is but for a moment, is getting me ready for glory, he said. Incomparable glory. What does this, what's happening right now, matter in the context of eternity and infinity? Verse 18 says, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. There are things that you can see that are impressive, but what makes them exciting is the fact that they enable you to see the invisible, the deep things of God. That's what we really need to focus our attention on. We don't want to get distracted by material stuff. Keep your eyes fixed on the invisible and the infinite and the eternal. This letter goes on. Paul discusses about how physical life is not real life. He says it's like a tent and we're going to be swallowed up in real life. And he makes this beautiful statement, just showing what a spiritual focus he had. He says, and he, Jesus Christ, died for all, that those who live might live no longer for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though we once regarded Christ from a human point of view, we regard him thus no longer. Paul no longer had just a human perspective. He had learned to think like God. He looked at other people the way God does. He saw trial and suffering the way God sees them. He looked at Christ the way God does. And he says here, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. He actually quotes a prophecy in Isaiah 65 about God creating new heavens and a new earth. And he relates that to what God is doing in the life of human beings. He's comparing God renewing the face of the earth with the way that he renews our lives. Earlier in that in chapter 4, he actually compared it to the renewal that takes place in Genesis 1. But here he's talking about beyond the millennium, beyond the great white throne judgment that will follow that. He's talking about the time of New Jerusalem. And he says, spiritually, you are already there. If you will rise above the sufferings of the moment, you can observe them as if they were already of the past. You are a new creation. Through the power of God, those old things are passed away. Remarkable, remarkable perspective that this man had. The prophet Isaiah described God in this way in Isaiah chapter 40. He's measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out heaven with the span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. He says, behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing. He's talking about the majesty, the awesomeness, the might of the Creator God. And he says, all nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him as less than nothing and vanity. To whom will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare unto him? And then he contrasts God's works and just the majesty of God's works with those of puny human beings. He says, the workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it over with gold and casts silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. You know, human beings can create some quite impressive craftsmanship, but if God isn't establishing it, it really amounts to idolatry. And people end up worshiping these things that are just made with human hands. And there is no comparison with the Almighty Eternal God. Verse 21 here in Isaiah 40 says, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? Just step back and get the overview here. It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. What awesome perspective. And what a picture here of this great God overlooking the entire earth. And this is biblical revelation that this planet is a globe. And it's so much bigger and greater than all the inhabitants, all these people who are fabricating idols and making sophisticated rockets and everything else that people make. God created the earth. It says that he stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent. And if you study into those words, they match what science is discovering about the origins and the current behavior of the universe. Isaiah wrote these words 2,700 years ago, but it's talking about the expanding universe. And it says in the next couple of verses that the greatest men on earth are vanity and they have nothing on God. And you look at even these impressive projects that they are doing, and why are they undertaking these projects? They really have a lack of perspective, and they have some quite silly ambitions when you understand what God intends for human beings. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, why are they sending civilians into space? Well, they're trying to, they say, ensure the long-term survival of humanity. Elon Musk says we have to become an interplanetary species in a spacefaring civilization. He wants to colonize Mars. He said that, you know, he's producing these Starship rockets. He says we need to take 1 million people to Mars and put a colony on Mars. Jeff Bezos, he says the way that we need to save humanity is by creating massive space stations. So think about what life would be like in these colonies, on these space stations. There is no place that supports life like Earth does. It's an absolute wasteland out there. If we do put a colony on Mars, if you go outside that controlled environment, you are dead. If you're in a spaceship or you're on some distant colony and you have to be enclosed within these prescribed boundaries, that would be a nightmare. That would be worse than COVID lockdowns. You know, in just reading about this and thinking about this, I find myself when I go outside and I see fresh air and trees and I see a lake and I see just how much beauty and just how wonderful it is to be able to go outside and to go for a run and to go for a swim and to just be able to enjoy the atmosphere on Earth. It just really makes me appreciate what God has given us here. But Mr. Fleury wrote in a Trumpet article, some dream of somehow escaping Earth and introducing life to Mars. Can they do that? Look at what human beings have done to this planet. We are about to destroy all human life on Earth. Even if we escaped, quote unquote, we would bring rebellious, destructive human nature with us. Even if we found life on Mars, we would just destroy it in the end. That's a difficult point to argue with. This passage in Isaiah 40 continues. God says, "To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal?" says the Holy One. "Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things that bring out their host by number? He calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one fails." Yes, look up at the heavens, but don't get distracted by a bunch of physical matter. It says, "Behold, who has created these things." Mr. Fleury wrote an article about the universe called The Ultimate Plan of God in the Royal Vision, and it says, astronomers say there are 2 to 3 trillion galaxies. The best they can figure, that means there are likely more stars than grains of sand on Earth. Yet God calls all the stars by name. This alone shows that he has a wonderful plan for the future of those stars and planets that orbit them. What an omnipotent creator we have. Verse 28 here says, "Have you not known, have you not heard that the everlasting God, the eternal, the creator of the ends of the earth, faints not, neither is weary?" There's no searching of his understanding. The universe that he created is so impressive, but really it's only impressive when you understand its purpose. All that real estate points to the Creator, and it points to the Creator's plans. This creation is spectacular, but in many ways, God is just getting started. In early 2021, NASA landed a rover on Mars, the Perseverance rover, and it's been working there ever since, and it's sending us pictures and video, and it's collecting rock and soil samples to bring back to Earth in a few years. It's just a phenomenal engineering achievement. But why are scientists doing that? Mr. Fleury wrote about this in a cover story of the Trumpet, May-June of 2021. Why do scientists want to reach Mars? It gets back to one overall question. Is there life there? But they are asking the wrong question. They should ask, why are Mars and the rest of the universe there? This question leads us to the Creator. Scientists are focused on the creation, not the Creator. And though it may be done in ignorance, it amounts to an exercise in futility and rebellion against God. In Romans 8, the Apostle Paul gives a marvelous perspective that we must remember. He says, "And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." Just a little bit of suffering leads to eternal glory. And Paul says here that when you look out at the universe and you see the state, you see a lot of waste and decay out there, but it's not going to be that way for very much longer. He says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of him who subjected it in hope, because the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God," or the sons of God. Right now, it's in bondage to decay. And at this point, there is no life out there. Scientists going to Mars are looking for life on a planet that is waste and decay. You know, you see the pictures of Mars. You see that bondage to decay. God created life on Earth. He created human beings for the purpose of actually spreading life to elsewhere in the universe, to make that flourish with beauty and with life. But right now, there is only one place in the universe where there is life. And that is where God specifically put it, where he renewed the face of the earth by his word, where he said, let there be light. And then he planted this planet with life. This planet truly is extraordinary. And it is such a contrast to everywhere else in the universe. Those civilian astronauts on that SpaceX mission, they were so impressed to look back at Earth from just a few hundred miles up. And in fact, their experience is very common among people who go to space. There's something remarkable that tends to happen when human beings gain that perspective. One astronaut also aboard International Space Station missions, Nicole Stott, she said, I think you start with this idea of what it's going to be like. And then when you do finally look at the Earth for the first time, you're overwhelmed by how much more beautiful it really is. It's just like it's this dynamic, alive place that you see glowing all the time. One astronaut said, when we originally went to the moon, our total focus was on the moon. We weren't thinking about looking back at the Earth, but now that we've done it, that may well be the most important reason we went. David Beaver, who founded the World Space Center, said, it really does look like this beautiful oasis out in the middle of nothingness. And if you have the chance for your eyes to adjust, and you can actually see the stars and the Milky Way, it's this oasis against the backdrop of infinity. These people look on Earth and they're awed by it, by that. They're awed by its beauty and its perfection. This planet really is an absolute miracle. And many astronauts say that seeing Earth from space is a transformative experience. Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell described it as an explosion of awareness and an overwhelming sense of oneness and connectedness, accompanied by an ecstasy, an epiphany. These types of reactions are so common that researchers have actually given them a name. They call it the overview effect. Frank White wrote a book called The Overview Effect, and he defines that as a set of truly transformative experiences involving senses of wonder and awe, unity with nature, transcendence, and universal brotherhood. The Overview Institute says that when you see Earth from space, it is immediately understood to be a tiny, fragile ball of life hanging in the void, shielded and nourished by a paper-thin atmosphere. From space, the astronauts tell us, national boundaries vanish, and conflicts that divide us become less important, and the need to create a planetary society with the united will to protect this, quote, pale blue dot becomes both obvious and imperative. It's amazing just the effect that this physical perspective has on these astronauts. Of course, God sees that view all the time. He sits upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent. Just think of his perspective on the conflicts that divide us and the need to create one global society with a united will, a world of real peace. The closer we are to the things on this earth, the more caught up in those things we are. But the higher we get and the more we set our affections on things above, the more we are going to experience that overview effect, a sense of awe and wonder and transcendence, a sense of how petty are the things that we get worked up over. We're going to be able to see beyond the current suffering and see how the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. This passage in Romans 8 continues, "We know that the whole creation has been groaning in travail together until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait for birth as sons, the redemption of our bodies." This is describing the earth and the universe as if they are in labor pains before God's people are born. Now, when you read that in most translations, it says that we're waiting for adoption. The translators put the word adoption there, even though the Greek word means birth, because they just can't believe what the Bible actually says. Mr. Fleury wrote in that Trumpet article, "We will not be adopted by God. We are going to be born into his family, and you can prove it. No wonder the word hope is used 5 times in verses 24 to 25. How awesome this truth is. And God is inviting you to be part of this magnificent universe-building program." That is perspective we need to cling to. That's a real view from higher up. That is the big overview. And that's looking to the future in a way that can get you through your most difficult trials, although you sometimes have to force your mind to the task. These space travelers have all these big plans. You know, they're excited about going up 50 miles or 66 miles. If Earth were the size of a basketball, that's about 1/20th of an inch off the surface of that basketball. Inspiration 4 crew, they were hovering at about 364 miles above the Earth's surface. So that, you know, just think about taking a road trip 364 miles. That's a few hours drive. And it's not even half an inch away from the surface of that basketball. And at that scale, meanwhile, the moon would be the size of a tennis ball, about 23 feet away. Mars would be the size of a shot put, over 2.5 miles away from that basketball. If our entire solar system, all the way out to Pluto, were shrunk to the size of a quarter, the Milky Way galaxy would be as big as the western half of the United States. And yet, when the Inspiration 4 crew capsule landed, the ground crew said, "Welcome back to planet Earth," as if they had traveled to another galaxy. These impressive projects, they're taking little pokes out into space, and they're talking like they are able to save humanity. And they're so excited about everything that's out there. It's space. But that means nothing compared to the future that God is offering to human beings. And if we can keep that perspective, we're going to be a lot more excited than these people are about these space projects. And we'll be willing to do anything to fulfill this godly ambition. In Romans 8, Paul says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose." That's tremendous perspective from a man who experienced so much tribulation. He really was able to rise above the sufferings of the moment with that perspective. And he said, "What shall we say then to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword?" He says, "I am persuaded that neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor powers nor things present nor things to come nor height nor depth nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." It's a man who had the big overview and who knew that in his bones. Those astronauts say that getting off this planet and visiting space makes them feel very small, very humble, but also somehow more connected to the rest of the universe. Frank White says that from space you see the sun as a star. We see the sun in the blue sky, but up there, you see the sun in a black sky. So you are seeing it from a cosmic perspective. You see that one star, that it's just one star in a galaxy of something like 200 to 400 billion stars. If the entire universe were shrunk to the scale so that Earth were the size of a grain of salt, our solar system would be about 450 miles wide. The nearest star would be 930 miles away, and the center of the Milky Way would be about 5 million miles away. That center point of our galaxy is about 27,000 light years away from us. For all 200 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy to make one revolution around that point takes about 250 million years. And the universe has something like 2 to 3 trillion galaxies like ours. Mr. Fleury wrote, "You have the potential to be sons of God, and you are here for the very purpose of ruling the earth and universe. We are here on earth to get ready for that. We are universe beings with universe potential." How important it is that we have the big overview. And we're not just talking about physical elevation. We're talking about viewing things the way God does, thinking like the great God of the universe. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Jonathan Swift, that the universe was formed by a fortuitous concourse of atoms. I will no more believe than that the accidental jumbling of the alphabet would fall into a most ingenious treatise of philosophy. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.